stay away, let's stay away. And that was the only contact. And that is true. And then one of my jobs on the paper was to work with her, the law firm that was, that always represented the Times, in libel threats or libel action. And,
Ray, let me just butt in to indicate that this is...
Oh, yes, pardon me.
August 28th. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about your function as investigator in cases where the Times was sued for libel.
Mm-hmm. A threat and suit. Yeah. We had a large number of suits over the years and a large number of threatened suits. Now, this was when the, before the libel laws have been, let's say, liberalized by Supreme Court decisions. It's harder to prove libel now than it used to be. And it's more difficult to, to libel a person. One I recall that we usually got rid of them, the policy was not to settle. The policy was to go to court if you had to, but try to get enough so it would not be enough on the persons who were suing. Because usually it was a legalized form of shakedown. To discourage their going to court, show them they couldn't win. And I, as I say, worked with the law firm and had all the help from the paper, the Hearst organization that I needed. But three lawsuits came out of one story that were rather interesting because we went to trial in circuit court in Detroit on all three of them. And in all three, the verdict was the same. It was that we had libeled the party, and we were assessed 6 cents. So we lost a total of 18 cents in the court, but we felt that we were victors in all three of the cases because these people, we thought we had successfully shown that they didn't have a reputation to be sullied, that they'd taken care of that themselves, and that what they wanted was money. And this was the big thing they wanted, was money. They made our correction, we ran a correction on the story, which I'll go into in a minute, which was, I thought, more than adequate and fair, and so did many people, but it was pretty obvious that this isn't what they wanted, that they wanted cash because they were making the terms of the correction just impossible. For instance, they wanted it in a double eight-column headline on page one and then a column down page one with a runover. The original story went almost that way. And they wanted the same space for in size of type for the correction. Well, of course, the original story also carried a lot of things about what the grand jury in general was doing at that time, having no connection with them. The story was headlined, Gun Gang Depot Blocked from City Hall. And the story said that gangsters in Detroit, and there are gang wars going on then, this was in the early 30s, there are gang wars going on, that the gangsters were buying their guns from this particular establishment, which was at Griswold and State. The building is now, I believe, torn down, but it was a very fine store for guns. It was owned by a major on active duty in the United States Army a graduate of West Point. He, however, was off around the country with his war duty, with his army duties, and his wife and a man had no connection when we started out in the investigation, ran the store. So the first thing I threw their attorney, they sued us one at a time. The first lawsuit was started by the man, the employee of the major and the major's wife. Now, we started out by finding out, first of all, did a gangster ever buy a gun there? And so far as I could determine, through all the connections that I had and that the rest of us had, nobody ever did. All our sales were legitimate sales. They had a pretty good stock. They weren't making much money. They weren't doing a big business. But it was a legitimate and a legal business, and our reporter, who got the information that they were supplying guns to gangsters, just made one hell of a big mistake. His source was obviously wrong because he couldn't back it up. Well, we ran a, what we thought was a very adequate correction and apology. But it wasn't acceptable. They wanted money. So we finally felt the only thing we could do was to go to court. Now, our policy was never to settle out of court because if word got around that, say, the Detroit Times would settle rather than go to trial, we thought it would encourage more people to sue us and we'd be having more than we could handle. However, when that policy changed, when the juries in about the 1950s, I believe, really started bringing in huge, enormous verdicts in libel cases. One of the early ones was the lawsuit between Westbrook Pegler and Quentin Reynolds. What was it, $100,000 or $150,000? And then there were big ones against the Saturday Evening Post, a couple. So we began looking around the country and seeing that the juries were assessing publishers. The trend completely changed. So then we started settling these things. However, until that time, we would go to court rather than give up anything and let them decide if we had to. When the, I remember when the employee of the, this gun company owned by the Army major took the witness stand, our attorney, one of the lead counsel for the Times, in cross-examining him, said, "Now, witness, what is your name? Is it Mr. So-and-so?" And he read off six names. And this came as a hell of a body blow and a surprise to the man, because we had shown that he did business or lived under six different names, because we went back to the day he was born and knew about everything he'd done. So he admitted that his name was so-and-so. It was one of the six. It was the right name. We knew that. Then I asked him about his residency. Now, he and the wife of the major lived in the same hotel and in rooms with a connecting bath. However, all the accounts from those two rooms had been destroyed when I got to the hotel. So the fact that they had rooms that were next to one another meant really nothing unless one wanted to use imagination. But I kept digging into all records of payments, and I found that whoever destroyed them didn't destroy enough, because going back it showed that she would pay, they rented their rooms either by the week or the month, I forget, but she'd pay one time, he'd pay the other for both. Their laundry would be charged at one or the other. Several things charged at the room might be charged at either room rather than completely separate. In addition to that, I got two former employees at the hotel to testify as to how they, what they saw on different occasions when they went in their room. Well, this was an awful rough thing to do because I felt sorry for the poor major who was sitting there listening to the case and hearing all these things about his wife. Incidentally, they were divorced afterwards. The we brought out that the man was not much of a citizen in that case, and they went to the jury. The jury deliberated and came back with a 6-cent verdict for him. Then the wife, trial went on, and the same thing happened. Pretty much the same, a lot of the same testimony, practically. Then the Army officer. And I was a little bit worried about him because he wasn't in Detroit even. But I'd been gone into his background since before he went to West Point. And talked with his commanding officers over the years, and he didn't stand out as any great, wonderful credit to the United States Army, yet there was nothing criminal against the man. But there were a lot of things that we could ask him about that didn't make him look like the poor, wronged gun merchant. I thought I had the best case. But the jury apparently didn't think so, because this was the third jury now by this time, the third judge. They brought back a 6-cent verdict, too. Right after that, he sued his wife for divorce. And they were divorced, and they all left the city, and the business closed. It was a tragic thing. I think if the moral of it, if there is one, is the danger that careless reporting, the damage that careless reporting can do. Because our reporter who had that story, at a time when there was great interest in gangsters shooting gangsters in Detroit, just didn't check far enough into it to be able to substantiate that this was true. He believed it, but he couldn't prove it. And the other thing was that I really felt badly about their marriage being broken up, because I don't think it was much of a marriage, though I'm not good at assessing those things. And whether it was a good marriage or a bad one, it was none of my business, irrelevant. But that broke up. The business was shattered. None of the papers printed anything about it. It was a standing, unwritten, unspoken agreement in those days that one paper didn't write about another's libel. And no one wrote about it. But nevertheless, the word got around and didn't help the reputation. And the whole damn thing was tragic. Well, the rest of the moral, I suppose, is greed. Number one, they were not irreparably or seriously hurt in any way by the original story when we came back with, not once, but twice, with corrections on the thing. And got the corrections in more papers than the original story. So I think that was wiped out. If they were, they were greedy. They wanted money, I'm convinced of it. If they hadn't been, and if they dropped it, they could have gone on living happily in sin ever after. But people always got hurt in those things. I suppose they do in most lawsuits, but in libel suits they did, because I found that almost everyone has something in his past. This sounds like a cliche, and it is a cliche. They can't stand the bright light, and if you work hard enough and have any luck, you can find out what that is. And my conscience never hurt me about that, because these people who were suing us were suing us, really, as I say, it was a legalized shakedown. The other people, if you put a correction in the paper, that satisfied them. Persons who had much better reputations than the ones that got lawyers right away and wanted to get money. Do you have a question?
Yeah. Ray, who was the attorney who handled most of the time?
Well, Butzel, Levin, Winston was a law firm, and Isidore Levin, who tried those three cases, and I don't think he tried law, I don't think he tried many cases. I know he didn't in the years that I dealt with him. Yeah, Chris Youngjohn was doing the court work, and then later on, Henry Silt. But Levin did a masterful job in all those trials. I've never seen better work done in a courtroom, in all the kinds of cases I've covered as a newspaper man. He was excellent. Now, he didn't practice much, but there's one part about it, those cases were prepared. The work was done on the street and in their office. And what went on in the courtroom was just bringing out all the things that had been done. So the lawsuit was won pretty much in their office, I think. But he did a masterful job. And he was a brilliant man, but he didn't do a lot of trial work.
Was any Ray Girardin story ever the subject of a libel action?
No, neither that, and I don't think even a threat of libel. I'm happy that was the case, because I used to handle the kind of stories that were not designed necessarily to make the people about whom they were written happy, but no, I was never sued, and or threatened. Nor did we have to retract. I don't mean that I was 100% right always, but if these retractions are tricky things, incidentally. If people call me, and they would ask me often, about a story in our paper or in another paper in which they were thought they'd been wronged, ask me what to do, and I'd say forget it, because I've seen more harm done by retractions than was originally done. In the first place, a lot of people didn't read the original story. But the chances are pretty good that if you give them two stories, that one they'll read, so they'll read the second, and then they get the wrong impression. They think that the person did what the paper said he didn't do in their correction. Some stories seem to be hoodoo. A mistake often gets into the correction. which makes the original thing 10 times worse. And you just, you know, you've got to drop it at some point, because it'll you'll have the person, you know, make a Jack the Ripper out of the poor victim. Because really, I believe that some stories are just jinxed from the very beginning. And the more you try to correct them, the more difficult it gets, because somebody along the line is going to make another mistake. Either the rewrite man who writes it, a copy desk editor who says, oh, they got this wrong, and puts it back of the way it originally was, because he remembers it. Or a printer, and it's not caught in the proof. And I've advised, I don't know how many people, look, forget the whole thing. You're not really hurt, nothing but your feelings a little bit. And you'll fool around with that, and you'll come out looking real bad. And I think I still think that's good advice.
You've told me on more than one occasion, Ray, that the way to prevent error from being perpetuated is simply to remove and destroy it from the newspaper file and ruin the story.
I used to do that with no authority at all. When a thing like that would come up, I'd go to the morgue and tear up the clippings, because the files by that time would be away in storage and be remote, that if any reference would mean that they'd ever get the files out, they'd just go to the, by the files I mean the entire paper, just destroy the clippings. And I think there ought to be a standard rule in every newspaper office that when, you know, something has gotten in print and it's wrong, that somebody be responsible to go into the files and destroy it. Because when the next story comes up, you see they send for the clips, and the reporter won't know anything about it, but he reads it, he assumes therefore that it's true, and he repeats it, writes it all over again. And this might come as after you've done all sorts of things to convince a person that the original story was an error, that there was no malice, that you love them, and then, boom, they get hit with the same thing again. So that's a lot of damage, and these papers don't do it. Duncan C. McCrae, that's M-C capital C-R-E-A, was elected prosecuting attorney of Wayne County in Detroit in the mid-30s, after he'd been an assistant prosecutor for many years. He was the kind of person who made news, made headlines, naturally. And at the time he was prosecutor, there's a great deal of graft and corruption between or among gamblers, prostitutes, police, the prosecutor's office, sheriff's office, mayor's office. It resulted in a grand jury and hundreds of people from public payroll going to prison. I had a feeling that Ed McCrae, who sued our newspaper for libel because we said he was a member of the infamous Black Legion, gone through with that lawsuit, the grand jury would not have been necessary, because we had collected enough material to, I'm sure, to cause a warrant to be issued for him, for some of his staff, and for others in the police department, others with whom he was taking graft. But the Black Legion is a story in itself. It was a gang of men, mostly from the South, who had come to Detroit, to some of the suburban towns, and worked in factories, or in Pontiac, I believe, some in the police department, and sheriff's office. And we had about the same rule book as the Ku Klux Klan, which reached its height in the 20s. They were very much against Catholics, Jews, and black people. They beat people up at night. They killed two people in Detroit, murdered two people in Detroit. And one of our reporters, shortly after this story was broken by the police, and some 20 black legionnaires were arrested in Detroit. And that was a very weird, wild story. Hard to believe that people be so moronic, but they were, at least 20 were later convicted in circuit court. They, one of our reporters got a membership card signed by prosecutor Duncan C. McRae. It was his handwriting. In fact, when confronted by it, he said, "It looks like my handwriting. It could be my handwriting, but I never belonged to it." So he then sued us because we ran a picture of the card on the front page of the paper, and saying that he had been a member. He sued us for libel. So I went to work on the thing, and I first was able to collect about, my recollection is, around 18 affidavits from members of the Black Legion who attended his initiation, which took place in an apartment in Harmon and Woodward in Detroit. These 18 were all, they'd all been definitely identified as members. They were admitted members. Some were under indictment. And however, they did give me freely their affidavits that they participated at his initiation. And because I'm sure he was initiated there.
It should be pointed out as an irony, Ray, that it was McRae, or at least his office, that was prosecuting these criminal cases against the Black.
It was, and because, that's right, and because, however, of his alleged involvement, the Attorney General came into the case, too, and had an Assistant Attorney General participate in the trial of these people in the circuit court. So they were prosecuted by both the Attorney General's office and the Wayne County Prosecutor's Office. Yeah, that's absolutely right. Well, he said that no, he didn't know any of the people, and he'd never been in this apartment and was not initiated. But then we began delving further into his activities while in the prosecutor's office and his background, and we got, the first time I was able to get definite and I think admissible evidence that he was being paid off handsomely to permit whorehouses and gambling to go on, some of it in Detroit and some of it outside Detroit, but in Wayne County, and that his bag man was his chief investigator, Harry Colburn. We also learned of the involvement of several others in the police department, sheriff's office, mayor's office at that time, and we're just waiting so anxiously for the suit to get started. However, for what reason, I don't know, but Mr. McRae did not pursue the libel suit. So we had all this information And then in the summer, in August of 1939, a woman named Janet McDonald wrote letters to the FBI, to several newspapers, and to the police, saying, telling about big payoffs from gamblers to the police. And she then killed her little girl and took her own life. And all this was because she was jilted by her lover, who was a gambler, and with whom I had gone to grade school in Detroit, a young kid. These were stories he had told her. But this came on top, these letters and the murder-suicide came on top of many other little things. For instance, the Board of Commerce cruise that year, at least one police officer distinguished himself by, in the dice game, by shooting $500 at one roll of the dice. Others aboard were gambling huge amounts of money, far beyond what they could afford to gamble if they were living on their salaries. The handbooks were wide open in Detroit. It was almost common knowledge that there was a general payoff, that the city had become terribly corrupt, and that it was being run by gamblers. You see, not long before that, that's a separate story. I'll leave that out. A couple of weeks before the murder-suicide, there had been a holdup of a doctor, an osteopath, who had an office in the Boulevard and Woodward Avenue. Dr. Robinson, and I think the hold-up guys, who were sort of fringe members of the Purple Gang, and they got about $25,000. And as they were driving away with the guns and money in the back seat, they were going through an alley, and they almost ran over a captain of police of the Mounted Bureau. They came out on Bethune. He was headed for the horse barns, where he had his office at Bethune and John R. And he arrested them, not knowing what he had, and marched them all to police headquarters, to the police precinct station, also at Bethune and John R., the old 9th precinct. They had $25,000 and these hold-up men, but no report of a hold-up. They held the men, but weren't successful in holding the money, because within a few days it had all disappeared from the station. And we found that out, of course, and that was a big, big story. So with all these things accumulating, it just about had to be a grand jury. However, I think if our libel suit had gone ahead, we'd have been able to bring out so much of this that probably it wouldn't have been a grand jury, but the grand jury started in September, and ironically, as prosecutor, Duncan McRae could have handled his grand jury himself, but he poo-pooed the whole thing and said it was all a lot of nonsense, so a grand jury was formed on petition of citizens, and Judge Homer Ferguson of Circuit Court was the grand juror, and Chester P. O'Hara, who was then an assistant prosecutor and later a circuit judge, was the chief prosecutor. And they had a large staff of investigators and assistant prosecutors, and that resulted in McRae going to prison, and as well as most uniformed police inspectors, that is precinct heads, and the mayor, the sheriff, and others high up in the sheriff's office, the, as I say, McRae, and of all people who turned on McRae, McRae covered himself pretty well. It was almost, it was impossible to show a direct payoff from any Racco to McRae. But he, McRae, had complete confidence in Harry Colburn, his chief investigator. Colburn was the bag man. He collected, and he was the only one who could put money in McRae's hands. And he collected on a regular basis and paid off regularly. And during, and he was a defendant with McRae and several others. And during the trial, he changed and turned state's evidence. And I had the exclusive story on that. They knew, the grand jury knew that he could do it. And at about 3 o'clock one morning, I got a telephone call at my home from a friend who said that Harry Colburn just told the grand jury the whole story and put McRae right in the middle of it. And they're writing it up now. And he gave me a lot of detail. So I had this story and several side stories. Of course, I worked the rest of the night on a hold for release. I didn't want to release it in case something happened and Colburn didn't take the stand. As it was said, he was to be the first witness when the trial of McRae and the others resumed that morning at, say, 9, 9:30. So I was covering the trial, about 100 defendants. And the trial was late getting started. And I knew why it was late. Nobody else did it, that is, who was, except the judge and the grand jury people. And Colburn. Now, Colburn's lawyer, who was a friend of mine, came over to me and said, Ray, the reason we're late, Harry had us go to the Internal Revenue this morning. Well, he believed that because Colburn had called him and said he was going to be late because he had to go over there. But he didn't know that Colburn had turned state's evidence. I couldn't tell him. And the story was in type, but we couldn't put it, and I didn't want to take a chance on putting it in the paper unless it was a follow-up. And this was being, the trial was being held in the supervisor's room of the old county building. Judge Ferguson's office was just down the hall. So finally the door opened and two men were leading Harry Colburn, who was deathly pale and whose legs wouldn't hold him up. And he just practically staggered to the witness stand. Call the office and said, release this story. And he got on the stand and he said, of course, McRae was so badly shaken. He never expected this, didn't know anything about it. And he told his story briefly, convincingly, and McRae jumped right up and started to cross-examine him. Obviously, he lost his head. And his questions were not good questions. And one of them was, you know that's not true, Harry. And his answer did more with the jury, I think, to destroy McRae than almost anything else. He said, I know it's true, and you know it's true, and God knows it's true. And with that, he slumped on the witness stand. And that ended the cross-examination. So everybody in that, and McRae and everybody with him in that conspiracy was found guilty. But that's where the Black Legion card led in a way.
You have a theory, Ray, as to why McRae joined the Legion.
Oh, yeah, I don't think he was really believed the things that they professed to believe in. I think that he didn't take time to examine what it was. I think he thought, oh, fine, here's our organization. When somebody asked him, here's an organization I don't belong to, and there's probably some votes there, so I'll sign up with it. But if he listened to the oath that he took. And I understood what they were saying. I don't know if you could even hear it, but it was a pretty wild, awful oath. Because he should have grabbed the card and torn it up and run like a burglar. But I think he just joined it for thinking there'd probably be votes on it, but he didn't know what it was. It's a hell of a... but poor excuse, of course, for a lawyer and a prosecutor. But I knew the guy well enough, so I don't think he was that kind of person.